I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day
a soldier of peace,
this nation will rise up,
a soldier of peace,
live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream,
though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it.
Nonviolence Radio, covering the beat of nonviolence worldwide, from the Meta Center for Nonviolence in Petaluma, California. This is Nonviolence Radio, and I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, here to continue our exploration of nonviolence as related to third-party nonviolent intervention, also known as unarmed civilian peacekeeping. Today we talk with Sarah Thompson, Executive Director of Christian Peacemaker Teams, about third-party nonviolent intervention work from a faith-based perspective, also working internationally and domestically. This interview was conducted by Michael Negler.
So we're speaking here with Sarah Thompson, who is the Executive Director of Christian Peacemaker Teams, and she is from Elkhart, Indiana. So Sarah, would you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, Elkhart, Indiana is traditionally on Potawatomi land, and I definitely want to give credit to the people of that land for cultivating it in such a way that did have a lot of really peaceful and awesome ways of existing. And many of them were marched out in the 1830s on the Trail of Death. And the people who came in after them, actually, many of those people were Mennonites. And so in that area are many Mennonites now, who did a lot of agricultural work. But Mennonites are known for some of the ways in which they have done peacemaking at home and around the world. And so it actually kind of makes sense that I'm from there and working with Christian Peacemaker Teams, because CPT came out of this question at Mennonite World Conference. In 1984, Ron Sider challenged these pacifists to say, you know, you all are willing to have armies protect you and you're able to remain peaceful, but what if you all as pacifists were willing to give of your lives like soldiers are giving of their lives? And what if you trained as hard for peace as militaries do for war? And so that actually did shock the Mennonite world into some deeper action. And this was also at the time of conscientización and a lot of consciousness raising that was happening across Latin America and into some of the early sanctuary movements. And so this kind of came together. Quakers, Brethren, some radical Catholics, even some Baptists and others got together with activists in solidarity with Latin America and formed Christian Peacemaker Teams.
Wow. Do you see Christian Peacemaker Teams and the institution that it represents, which we usually call unarmed civilian peacekeeping or protection these days, do you see that as a substitute for war?
So what we do at CPT is send small teams that are trained in third-party nonviolent intervention, as well as trained in human rights documentation and trained in accompaniment techniques that we have learned from the communities themselves about what they say keeps them safe, and that we've learned from other organizations in the field with regards to best practices in unarmed civilian protection. And so in so many ways, every act that these communities are doing, and when we find ways to protect one another without the use of guns, we are reducing, we're reducing war, we're reducing the need for it, and we're showing another way.
How many organizations are doing this kind of work around the world today that you know of?
You know, I would say there's not enough. What I mean is there's always more room for creative ways that we can protect one another. And increasingly, as we're seeing connections between militaries and police forces, it's also going to be really important to have more people to do cop watches. We're to have more people to do the type of protection of one another so we can decrease brutality, both from the police and from military entities. So That's important work that needs to happen. There are a number that we work with in the field, both nationally based in terms of, for example, in Colombia, there's some nationally based organizations that are working on the human rights of Colombians, such as Cocopana and others. And we also work with other international organizations as well, Peace Brigades International, Witness for Peace, Colombian Accompaniment Program of the Presbyterian Church, Nonviolent Peace Force, and Christian Peacemaker Team. So there are numbers, NISQA in Guatemala, number of people trying this methodology, and in many ways, it's like trying to deal with bullying in any forms. Like, you know, people may try to appeal to an authority figure, but if an authority figure in a situation with a bully is not responsive, what someone needs who's being bullied is more friends, you know, people to be around, to observe what's going on, to say this is not normal, to make sure that they can get from point A to point B safely, and, you know, who can challenge the media messages and the corruption that's happening. And that's what often friends can do. And these can be friends both from other, you know, villages within the same region or from other villages from across the water. And so we try to combine the gifts of what it means to be insiders and outsiders to any given community and find ways to keep one another safe and also to make space for more creative, nonviolent political tactics that can arise when people have the space to consider nonviolent options and alternatives.
What are some of those tactics, Sarah?
For example, in northern Iraq, a number of Kurdish civilians returned to their village in Golan to find that oil companies were doing some drilling really without their consent and were really having a major impact on everything from agricultural practices to gender roles in the community. And they asked CPT to accompany them as they did a public demonstration that frankly said, "We will not trade our water for oil." And so by CPT accompanying them, making a movie together with them, we were able to get the word out about what a frontline community in northern Iraq was doing in the face of ecological degradation of their traditional lands and their lifeways. And then later, one of the people who was involved in working on that public demonstration was also coming to the United States, and we were able to link them up with some of the people at Standing Rock and the Mississippi Stand, two groups of people who were also here saying, "We will not trade our water for oil." And so that type of South-to-South or Global South within the Global North type of collaboration is really key and really interesting in terms of what can help make our world population stronger in terms of knowing these nonviolent alternatives, knowing that they're not alone, and understanding that the indigenous peoples of this country are linked with the indigenous peoples of Iraq, Iran, Syria, Turkey. And so that's been really exciting to see that movement collaboration in unarmed civilian protection. Really, it's a sharing of strategies as well of the people who are most impacted by violence.
What role does faith play in CPT? The reason I ask this is you have these groups that are doing exactly the same thing, and some of them are explicitly faith-based and some are not. Can you talk about that a little bit?
There are two major roles that I see faith playing in CPT. One is external and one is internal. In terms of internal, for myself, for example, as a person of faith, I can always remember that the actions that I'm taking are not ultimate. My actions are penultimate, and I can give my all, and I can be bold and passionate and nonviolent and committed to the understanding that I'm going to do the best I can, but I may be wrong. I'm going to do the best I can, but I don't know everything. I'm going to do the best I can, but it's not up to me to fix it. So the stance that faith allows in terms of releasing the bigger picture to the one, you know, to the ultimate force that is in this world, and also a way of connecting with people in terms of practices that you do to help keep your courage up, that help connect you to a broader story, that reminds you that you're not the first person or the first generation to come up with some of this, but that you stand in a long line of ancestors who have been, you know, taking that moral arc of the universe, as Dr. King would talk about it, and just grabbing onto that moral arc of the universe as it bends towards justice and, like, pulling it down, you know, just holding on and just knowing that you stand in a great line of people who have tried a lot of different things to create a world where everyone has enough to eat, where people are safe, where people can live in peace. So that's the internal impact. It can really help you get up each day and to know that you are cared for, that you are beloved, and that the people you're interacting with are also beloved, that they are not just an enemy other, but that our adversaries are those who we just haven't won over yet, and a recognition that we're really all in this together, and that they may see you as an adversary, but that you can like see their humanity in a deep way. So that internal orientation is important, and then externally, it's very important, Christian Peacemaker teams, that we clarify that we respect everyone's path to God. We're not a missionary organization at all, but we're actually calling Christians to know that the center of our faith is not violence and consumption and conversion of other people, but the center of our faith is nonviolence and generosity and invitation. And so we're actually very clearly critiquing Christian hegemony, as Paul Kibble would say. We're very much addressing the ways in which imperial Christianity has created really intense binaries and pitted people against each other and gone around the world and changed and affected culture in such a way that has had major devastating impacts. And so we actually want to be a part of the reparation of the healing of the world. So some of that means to reduce the impact that imperial Christianity has had. That said, Christian Peacemaker Teams welcomes people of all faiths and walks of life to participate in it. And so everyone's welcome to come on like a two-week delegation to see what our teams are up to on the ground in northern Iraq, Palestine, Colombia, and alongside First Nations here on Turtle Island, North America. We also have some regional expressions in West Papua, as well as on the island of Lesbos in Greece, alongside refugees. So anyone's welcome to come see for 2 weeks what we're up to participate with our teams, to see what unarmed civilian protection looks like, to learn from the teams on the ground, and especially the communities we work with and those most affected by violence. And then after that, you can participate in a training, 1 month training, in which you do look at the role of a faith and religious peacemaking. And we actually also examine the roles of religious violence and the ways in which religion has been instrumentalized to perpetuate violence and inequity. And what might we be able to do to repair that? You look at your personality in this training. You look at conflict transformation and how to live well and work well on a team. And you learn things like geography, you start learning language, you start spending time also developing community through spirituality. And we also learn quite a bit about undoing oppressions, right? Because violence is not just out there in Iraq, out there in Palestine, out there in Colombia. But as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, you know, violence, nonviolence run through the heart of each one of us. And so needing to see how the structures of oppression have deformed us and have hurt us and the work that we need to do within our organization and within how we do our work to address racism, sexism, heterosexism, Christian hegemony, etc. So that's also all a part of our training. So you go on a delegation, then you can go to training, and then you can become a CPTer if you want.
I'm going to ask you later a little more in detail about exactly how people can get into that, but I was really struck by something you said, because I was expecting you to say that it's very helpful to be part of a worldwide organization, you know, in the Saul Alinsky sense, that it's very hard to build a movement without having like a church or a union or some pre-existing organization to work within and to help you rise. And of course, the Vatican Nonviolence group is experiencing that very strongly right now. So, but it sounds to me like you are going to be helping Christianity more than Christianity helping you.
You know, I appreciate what you just said, because it's really been enlivening and freeing to be a part of the liberation movements of theology and Christianity. And so we are grateful for the visionaries in the faith that have seen that and who have pushed back against the hegemonic manifestations of our faiths. But it's also humbling and a great reminder that everyone's on a journey, and that our institutions also can bring a type of stability and support for more creative expressions for how we want to show up in the world.
Now, is Christian Peacemaker Teams, the group that you are the executive director of, is that the only one or one of the few that does both what we call cross-border intervention, you know, over the sea, as you said, and domestic, or are other groups getting into this picture? The reason I ask is that Gandhi's original plan was for very small, local, community-based groups. And he sort of realized that probably that this could be internationalized, but that wasn't the way he thought of it. When the Shanti Sena was going to be very local. But we're starting kind of from the other direction.
One thing we do is we relocate the United States and Canada within the community of nations. And so all of our projects are treated as international projects because we need human rights observation here in this country based on what's been going on, particularly in light of the settler colonialism that has impacted First Nations, but also as we can see the ways in which the depth of violence against communities of color and women continues to be very high within Canada and the United States. So there are people from other countries within the CPT network that come here and who do observation. So there's no such thing as a certain domestic program. And each place where we're at, so-called around the world, also has people who are local there as well. Maybe not to that specific community, but again, playing with that insider-outsider dynamic so that we might be able to have the most impact possible.
Do you do what PBI and NP try to do, which is to build capacity on the ground and then quietly step out and let the local people handle their own conflicts?
So we only go where we're invited, and we generally are not known to take a neutral stance. PBI, to some extent, does explicitly neutral work and therefore will notify both the government of the sending country and the government of the receiving country as to what their work will be. We generally don't notify either governments, and we are very much a people-to-people type of entity. And we go where we're invited. We're invited by coalitions of fairly organized folks already who say, hey, this is a moment in our struggle where we could use international leverage and we could use some support in getting the word out and transforming the situation. So we answer at a particular moment of struggle. And at first in CPT, we did used to run shorter term delegations in different places such as Haiti, Vieques, where the U.S. was doing bombing, Chiapas, you know, under the severe duress impacted by NAFTA trade agreement, etc. But now we're doing work that's a little bit more longer term, and that has built deep relationships. For sure, the folks we're working alongside were resisting before we got there and will continue to resist after we leave. And we do believe that capacity gets built, both for the CPTers to return to wherever their home is. CPTers come from about 16 different countries. So they'll be able to return to wherever their home is and build capacity there. As well as, you know, through the interchange, any exchange of people will build a capacity in one way, shape, or form. We do not do material aid because it takes a whole other level of organizational management and size and capacity. And we are there mainly as friends with the Ministry of Presence, but also with cameras and access and the commitment to go the full mile with the communities wherever they ask us to go. So that's how we differ from a relief organization in the sense that if the community requests in nonviolent direct action or participation in marches, etc., we will do things like that. We're not strictly observers. We are, in some ways, participants in what's happening in the conflict itself.
What kind of communication or collaboration exists among UCP organizations?
The main one would be on the ground. If we're ever in a similar place on the ground, we will have conversations and we will figure out how to support one another. We will sometimes trade information and reports. So that's the main thing that's happening. I do believe that, at least during my tenure, I've gotten to know Mel Duncan, and I got to talk to Amelia Parker. So that, you know, those are people from MP, PBI, and I think those links are really important because it's important to support one another. NP and PBI have more robust lobbying setups than we do and see as part of their work some particular advocacy around either European or North American governments. We will give our raw data to anyone in the international community who needs it and who wants to do that type of advocacy. But when we lobby in many ways, we're lobbying communities of faith. To change their opinions, and then if they would like, they can put pressure on their elected officials. But we're also lobbying to get our theology changed. This is, for example, the doctrine of discovery. Doctrine of Discoveries, 1482 Papal Bull, and it's one that, you know, sought to resolve a dispute between Spain and Portugal about whose land something could be, depending on whose flag was there, and it was resolved by the Vatican by kind of saying, hey, if there aren't any Christians around in the area where you go before your flag's there, then you can basically consider the land terra nullis, kind of without people, and you can do whatever to it. That's very deep in our theology. It got encoded into U.S. law later in the 1800s. And so figuring out ways to undo that in our theology, in the ways that we think about other people, in the ways that we think about non-Christians, in the ways that we think about folks from various cultures, it's really key that we address our theology and see how colonization has formed our worldview. So we are kind of lobbying folks for worldview change in many ways. And so in that way, we wouldn't have as much overlap with PBI and NP because our constituents are somewhat different. And we really are trying to work with people of faith to see peacemaking as a key expression of their faith and decolonization and a commitment to anti-racism as cornerstones for the ways that we want to show up in the world.
We're talking with Sarah Thompson, the Executive Director of Christian Peacemaker Teams. Sarah, you mentioned work which sounds quite parallel to what the Vatican Nonviolence Group is doing. They are working on a reversal of the just war doctrine and trying to go from there towards a possible encyclical on nonviolence within the Catholic Church. Now, you're working against the doctrine of discovery within somewhat different Christian communities. Have you been in touch with one another, or are you you're just kind of supporting one another in spirit?
It is so exciting what has been happening in that group and a recognition of how slow an institution like that moves. I'm so grateful just to be alive at the moment where these conversations, which have been had for a long time, are getting more play on the world stage. It's just so humbling and awesome time to be alive. Yes, I am in conversation with that group, and they have already been meeting periodically, and I really just received an email last week that invited us to step into that conversation in a specific way. When I first lived out here in the Bay, I had an awesome opportunity to intern with Pache Bene, and the work of Ken Buttigan and others really connected me into that world more. And so since CPT has always been ecumenical, I think this is a great way for us to be connected. And, you know, also, you know, rethinking just war theory is really key, especially after the Laudato Si encyclical on the environment. Peacemaking and environmental justice go hand in hand. Everywhere CPT works, it's not just a social justice struggle. It's not just an environmental struggle. It's about what's happening with the people, what's happening with the trees in a particular place. And so these are one in the same quest for liberation. How we live well with each other has a lot to do with how well we live with land. And I would add how we understand and live well in a certain understanding of divinity, as well as what's happening in our internal environment. So it's really awesome to be alive and to be around in a moment in which people are seeing these struggles together, and which there's some recognition from the Vatican about it. Although I'm not, you know, always a Vatican watcher, what's happening on the grassroots is really what lights my fire.
You really are talking about worldview change, and I'm not sorry. We're getting close to the end. I'd like to ask you a rather difficult question, not to put you on the spot, but because this question is often posed to people who start talking to different audiences who aren't familiar with the concept about UCP, about going, or what you call third-party nonviolent intervention, a term that I actually like a little better. The first thing people tend to say is, isn't that horribly dangerous? And the statistics say that no, it's a lot less dangerous than being armed and shooting at people. On the other hand, we do lose people, and CPT has lost a couple of people. I wonder how you dealt with that, how you feel about it. Has it impacted your volunteer supply?
Thank you so much for that question, because it's real and a lot of people are thinking about it. One thing that I appreciate about being a peacemaker and being with people who are willing to give of their lives daily and maybe even give the ultimate gift of their lives in terms of it being lost in a scenario. One thing I love about it is that when this happens, we don't have to soldier on. Many soldiers who die, it's very difficult for their families to grieve because they get told, oh, well, they die for the national cause. And keep your head up, stay strong, don't show how painful this is, or don't show how much this is a recognition of the fact that the world's pretty messed up. But when we lose people, when we lost Tom Fox, or the recent death of my dear friend Michael Sharp in the Congo, he was a UN worker at this time, but he did spend some time with CPT in 2008, 2009. I took 2 weeks off work. You know, you really stop and you listen and you grieve and you are with your friends and you comfort each other and you don't have to pretend that anything makes sense. You can feel the sadness and that connection with what many people around the world are going through on the daily because of the ongoing drone violence, ongoing military violence, ongoing violence of the economic system, ongoing refugee struggle. So it's a moment to actually feel the depth of solidarity with those that we're with who are losing people all the time. And also it's a really important time of reevaluation of whether or not you would like to keep doing this, and that's the way that you would want to be. So we have some more freedom around this time, and we try to take care of each other best as possible, and entering into the grief of all of this is a necessary part of the work. So, yes, the statistics show we don't lose people near as often, and so with that, when someone is killed, people still sign up because they can see the validity in the work that we do, and they can see that now is the time that you need more peacemakers, not less.
That's been a consistent observation, actually, throughout the nonviolence world. I remember right after the independence of most of India, Goa was not liberated by the Portuguese, was not decolonized, and a group of 70 people, I think, walked into Goa from surrounding areas, and they were met with gunfire, and they lost people. And the next day, I think 500 volunteers showed up. So it is quite remarkable, and it's quite remarkable what you said about the grieving being a way of recognizing our unity with one another. Well, Sarah, we could go on for a long, long time, but I just want to make sure that I ask you, how can people find out more, get in touch with CPT?
Yeah, for sure. Check out our website, cpt.org. There's a lot there, and you can come on a delegation for 2 weeks, have your community help you fundraise for the plane ticket and about a 10-day trip to see what life is really like on the ground in places where our so-called enemies live. You will find many friends and learn a lot. So that's one thing. Just come on our delegations. Check that out, cpt.org. The schedule is there. And then if you discern that this way of being, again, we invite people from all walks of life and any faith background to join us. There's a month-long training that's possible. That happens about once or twice a year. And then after that, you can sign up for 3 years as someone on full-time. We've got jobs with a stipend that will cover your living needs, and you'll work together with a team on the ground in a specific location or as part of the administrative team, either out of Chicago or elsewhere. So you can work full-time or part-time if you're like a teacher or something. And then you can be a reservist, too, if you have another type of job that generates income or other things that you are predominantly doing with your life but would like to supply our teams for 2 weeks to 2 months at a time, then you can be a reservist as well. That's a volunteer position.
There is an indefinable, mysterious power that pervades everything. It transcends the senses. While everything around me is ever changing, ever dying, there is a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates. Ishwari Allah, Tero Naam, Sabko Sammati De Bhagavan. Ishwari Allah,
breaks out, nothing but silence. From the mainstream media show, we want to know about nonviolence. Where do we go? Nonviolence Radio. Tell your friend, tell your foe.
Ooh, nonviolence.
Challenging
radio.
Silence.
Nonviolence.
Challenging
radio.
Silence.
Ooh, nonviolence radio.
Challenging silence.
Greetings, everyone. Time to challenge silence again. And I find myself faced once again with an embarrassment of riches. There is a lot of nonviolent noise going on out there. And I'd like to recur to something that we talked about in the last episode of Nonviolence in the News. If you recall, and I hope you do, because I hope you're a steady listener, we talked about three interesting and hopeful trends that seem to be coming out of the situation we find ourselves in. The first was a devolution of political authority and decision making, which is a response to the vacuum at the best, at the top. The second is a religious political awakening, of which we heard a superb example just now with Sarah Thompson of Christian Peacemaker Teams. And the third was what we sometimes call culture jamming with a group called Subvertising. But since I talked about that 2 weeks ago, the devolution piece has become a knockdown, drag-out fight between states and cities in many parts of the country, where states, if you recall, three-fifths of our governors are Republicans, that is to say, quote, conservative, unquote. I don't call destroying the planet conservative, but that's what they're called. And many states and communities are much more aware of issues and people. I was reminded that I once heard a story from the family of a rabbi who had grown up on the outskirts of Berlin. And when the word came out from Berlin, there was time to persecute the Jews in that community. They couldn't persecute him because they knew him. He was a respected member of the community. And so these Germans took a risk in not following orders. And that came from the fact that they were close to that person and knew him. So getting power back down on the ground is very important for a vital democracy, and it has become very much a struggle. Okay, so let's go on to our trifecta news here. First, to mention resources. Because there's so much going on, I want to start by saying once again that Nonviolent Conflict News, put out by International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, is a very useful resource which aims to be a dedicated, reliable source of international media coverage on civil resistance, which is one important and public aspect of nonviolence. They are saying that while single protests get the attention of media outlets, they aim to go beyond and provide a window into in-depth analysis of civil resistance movements, their dynamics, and the full range of nonviolent tactics that they use. They like to highlight each story's relevance to the dynamics of civil resistance, to a specific movement or campaign, or to the larger context of such events. If you're looking for a party game, you might want to compare their analysis with ours at the Meta Center. We have a very interesting complementarity. There's an audio available online now from Vimala Takkar. It's coming to me from Awaken Weekly. You can look that up in Surface Space, Awaken Weekly. And this audio of hers is called The Force of Love is the Force of Total Revolution. So if you like that title as much as I do, go and give that one a listen. I want to mention some films and a book or two. There's a film coming out soon called The Women's March. This is the march that took place on January 21st, which was not in celebration of my birthday, which had taken place the day earlier, but nonetheless important. It's been called the largest one-day demonstration, actually, in United States history, and you can find the trailer on Eventbrite online. And another film which deals with the new story, which we consider to be a critically important dimension of the nonviolent change. This film is called The End of Normal. It interviews Charles Eisenstein, Vandana Shiva, and many others. It looks like a very, very well-made film. Now, as for books, this is a response to the idea of one-off protests and marches.
by a person whose ideas and opinions I respect very much, Naomi Klein. Her book is called No Is Not Enough. And we couldn't agree more with that sentiment. And there's now an interview where she and Michelle Alexander were both interviewed on Truth Out. And Stephanie, I know you had some comments on that interview. Do you want to share that with us?
Sure. So people know Naomi Klein as the Canadian woman who brought out the shock doctrine theory to the public, and also Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow. And they were in discussion. The title of the article had to do with the we need a strategy for movement of movements. And this is something that we've been talking about in nonviolence and at the Meta Center in particular for quite some time. We need a strategy for movement of movements. So on the one hand, it's very heartening to see that people in the spotlight that have generated a lot of interest around the dynamics of oppression and violence and how the exploitation happens are calling for this need for cooperation and collaboration among different movements that have similar interests. However, I had certain concerns, and at least three. And so the first concern is that calling for a strategy is not a replacement of a strategy. So we have to do more than keep talking about the need for a strategy, which has been going on for decades, and to get out of that conversation and to actually, this is how we're going to get, this is from A to B. And, you know, we're going to, just like, you know, you're hungry, you want lunch, and you have to do more than say, give us food. You have to say what kind of food you want, where are you going to go get the food? And then you have to have a game plan for who's going to get the food, who's going to put it on the table, who's going to clean the dishes when you're done. Those are all parts of a strategy, just to use a silly example. Now, I find that in Klein's work and in Alexander's work, there's a great explanation of the problem as it is, but there's not really a way out that is strategic. It's usually what I found. There's a number of platforms out there that can describe the problem and also list a platform of demand. So Klein in particular represents this LEAP manifesto that they brought together people in Canada for a leap into a better climate system for dealing with the changes in our climate and taking care of the environment. But when you really read it, you find that it's an inspiring document without any substance behind how are we going to get to point A to point B. And similarly, other movements have had platforms out there, but they're not strategies. They're not explaining, first, everybody get behind this idea that in our local area, we're going to form teams of 10 people and do this and this and this. So there's no agreement on that. And so those are my concerns with these kinds of articles. Let's be heartened that they're out there and people are calling for it. And let's actually do the strategy work that's required. Oh, there's my other one, is that I'm afraid of the Sanderization, I'm calling it, the Sanderization of leaders, of thought leaders, to be required then by movement of movement to lead the movement for them, so that we're waiting for Klein and Alexander to propose the strategy for us, even though they're talking about it. So it's actually up to the grassroots people to create a strategy and show it to them instead, because as we saw even with the candidate Sanders, he ended up, you know, creating another organization that was coming out of his campaign, and people aren't really taking it that seriously. I have to say, like, it's not, definitely not the same energy that went into his campaign itself. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephanie. And you'll be glad to know, though you know as well as I, that Meta is in fact hammering out a couple of strategies, one for the new story and one for a trajectory that arises from restorative justice. More on that later. But let's go on to the news. And the first thing I want to tell you is the date. Today is July 7th. And if you are a faithful listener, you know why that is significant. It's significant because the UN Disarmament Commission was to adopt a draft that would be a step towards nuclear disarmament, and they did it. It was they're hoping for a complete ban on nuclear weapons. Here's part of their statement. Today, 72 years after their invention, states at the United Nations formally adopted a treaty which categorically prohibits nuclear weapons. with 122 votes in favor, one vote against, and one country abstaining, that is, on the committee. The United States and 39 other nuclear-armed states were abstaining from the entire process, as we know. But this treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons was adopted this very morning. So this is in the category of this just in and the category of top of the news. And it will be open for signature by states at the United Nations in New York on September 20th. More than 140 states and civil society organizations within those states have participated on those negotiations. I mentioned before Beatrice Finn, who was the executive director of one of the major organizations. She said, "We hope that today marks the beginning of the end of the nuclear age. It is beyond question that nuclear weapons violate the laws of war and pose a clear danger to global security. No one believes that indiscriminately killing millions of civilians is acceptable, no matter what the circumstances, yet that is exactly what nuclear weapons are designed to do." And our friend Kathy Kelly from Chicago comments that this historic ban means that participants in the G20 summit, which is going on in Hamburg, should kiss the ground on which the negotiations have walked, negotiators have walked this week, revering all who've committed countless hours toward making this wise decision happen. So, with some reluctance, moving on from there, toward the end of last month, 50,000 people formed a chain 90 kilometers long at the corner of Belgium, Holland, and France to shut down nuclear plants that were constructed in Belgium in the early 1980s. They were never supposed to last this long. They pose a clear and present danger. And commentators are saying that it's very likely that this march, again, 60 or so miles long, will actually have an effect on the Belgian government. Snide comment coming up to my lips about other governments, but I will pass them by. But I do want to point out a parallel. As we speak, there is a march going on in Turkey from the capital Ankara to Istanbul, 250 miles, and packed with tens of thousands of marchers. They're scheduled to arrive in Istanbul on Sunday. And the point of this march is to protest the increasingly oppressive and authoritarian policies of President Erdogan. Now, it might be interesting to compare and contrast the Salt March of 1930. This would be the comment I'd like to offer. In 1930, in April, Gandhi set out from his ashram with 72 co-workers, reached the sea at Dandin 12 days later, having covered almost the same distance, about 212 miles. And there were tens of thousands with him at that point. This is considered, rightly, I think, the climax of the climax, the moment when he picks up salt on the shore of the sea at Dandin was the climax of the salt campaign, which was the climax of the freedom struggle, and it was inevitable that freedom would come a few years later. Now, it's an example of many things at Salt March, but I'm interested here in contrasting it with this march in Turkey, because Gandhi arrives in India in 1916, so by 1930, he has spent almost 15 years working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, to create this movement from the ground up. So that's the prehistory. Now, the post-history was that they had many, many things up their sleeve in addition to the Salt March. They were picketing the liquor shops. They were boycotting British cloth. And here's the really important point. From my point of view, that march climaxed in civil disobedience. It was not merely a protest. And that seems to be putting the critical teeth into the movement. If you're familiar with page 108 of Search for a Nonviolent Future, you know that we have this scheme called the conflict escalation curve. In stage one, when the intensity of a conflict is relatively low, the dehumanization is not high, you can get somewhere by making your views known. But there comes a point when you cannot. The opponent knows what you care and not care about, but he or she does not care about your views. At that point, protesting is not enough, and you need to go on towards civil disobedience, into civil disobedience. So I hope that the people in Turkey will be considering all these things. They may be involved in civil disobedience in the sense that there may well be some serious oppression and violence against the marchers in Istanbul. It remains to be seen. But in another more local and stunning development, I am very pleased to announce that our dear friend, Representative Barbara Lee from the 13th District in Oakland, was on the House Appropriations Committee. Now, you may remember, if you're old enough, that 16 years ago, Representative Lee was the sole congressperson who voted against something called the AUMF, which is a blanket appropriation for military force, and basically, and I think unconstitutionally, gave the ability unhindered to wage war anywhere to any president. And that's exactly what every single president since there has done, involving us, for example, in what military strategists say was the greatest military disaster in American history, the Iraq War. So she has the great honor of having voted against terrific pressure, voted against that when it was initiated 16 years ago. And just a couple of weeks ago, she proposed a bill in the House Appropriations Committee to withdraw the AUMF and put an end to that whole practice. And the committee overwhelmingly approved this amendment to revoke that authority, and then they broke into applause. Of course, it is not law yet. It has to go to the House floor, and it has to go to the Senate. But Democrat Tim Kaine and Republicans Jeff Flake and Rand Paul have voiced support for doing something similar on the Senate side. It was, as a matter of fact, quite inspiring to listen to that vote where the chairman calls for all those in favor, and there's this roar of approval, and he says, all those opposed. Dead silence. So it passes, and then they break out into a round of applause. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always loved Barbara Lee, but now it's over the top. On the science side, I like to work in some of this. There was a statistics-based report that showed that where states had adopted the so-called right to carry or concealed handgun law, that homicide went down in those states. But the National Research Council on Firearms and Violence felt that something was wrong with this study, and they did a much more sophisticated statistical analysis, which is not cherry-picking, that looked at all the data, and they showed that over 14 years beyond what the original panel had studied, 15% of increase in gun homicides happened. So the theory that the only thing stronger than a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun falls to the ground. And our theory is that the only thing stronger than a bad guy with a gun is somebody without a gun who doesn't divide the world into bad guys and good guys. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, there's a very nice video on Facebook of a very distraught man walking into a police station in Indonesia with a big knife, and he's confronted by this policeman who could easily have pulled out his sidearm and shot the man dead. But instead, he keeps his arms visible and leans back on the desk in an obvious gesture of relaxation and involves this man in a conversation. And within 5 minutes, the man is crying. He's dropped his knife. The policeman steps up, gives him a big hug, listens to his story, and end of what could have easily been a violent episode. Ranging around the world and cherry-picking from all the good news that's out there, there's a journalist called Streko Horvat. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. He's from Al Jazeera. I picked this up from Common Dreams. About what's called the DIEM25, or the Pan-European Movement of Democracy, of Democrats, in which he calls for, he says, beside disobedience, we need something called constructive disobedience. He goes on to say, it's not enough to say no or protest, which is what I've been stressing all along. It is not enough to meet and discuss, unless you happen to still be in stage one. And it's not enough, certainly, to criticize others or disobey by enacting violence. So what he calls for is a constructive proposal that should be a blueprint for the Internet of People, as he calls it, based on protecting human rights and the digital commons when it comes to the sale of weapons and such things. And in this positive constructive disobedience, he adds, we should also create a new non-aligned movement which would work towards implementing these policies, very much along the lines of your comment, especially Stephanie, about Naomi Klein and Michelle Alexander. Horvat is, incidentally, a philosopher from Croatia, and his latest books include one called Subversion and another called The Radicality of Love, 2015. I haven't read those titles, but it looks like they're in English, and it looks like I should. Today, recently, actually, the FARC surrendered its weapons. This is the Frente Armada Revolucionaria de Colombia, which was the main guerrilla group in Colombia, essentially ending the armed phase of the longest war in the Western Hemisphere, a war that has gone on for 54 years. They have surrendered their weapons. It was surrounded by controversy, but it looks as if the president of Colombia did something necessary by bypassing the popular referenda and actually taking these people to rehabilitation camps and getting this thing over. Problems, dangers are not over, but this is a huge step. Now, an interesting move is calling for an educational paradigm shift by native peoples. They say neither native peoples nor the planet can afford systems of education that are built on reduction of life to transactional relationships, whether for profit or individual advancement. So they have started schools where a very Gandhian type of education is taking place. For example, the Defenders of the Water School, which was founded by Elena Eagle Shield at the Oseti Sakowin camp, had a curriculum centered on Lakota language and culture, in which the students at school spend their days in song, dance, and prayer. Whoa, Midwood High School was not like that. As well as learning the history, math, and science embedded in their surroundings. So that's the Gandhian part. Most importantly, they were there, witnessing the courageous actions taking place in defense of water. Now, having said one nice thing about Oakland, I'd like to say another, that the city of Oakland, and I suspect that Barbara Lee had a hand in this, has a Department of Violence Prevention. And they did a very good thing last month on June 20th to create a Department of Violence Prevention with a chief of violence prevention reporting directly to the city administration, and a mandate to work directly with victims of violent crime and those who are most likely to be future victims or perpetrators of violent crime by pursuing a public health approach to dramatically reduce violent crime and end the cycle of trauma impacting those communities in a city where men of color are 62 times more likely to be murdered than their white compatriots. In the event category, I have time to mention only one, and that is on August 6th, the Petaluma Progressives will be having their fair in Petaluma, California. We will be there, Meta Center, and there will also be a Bharatanatyam dancer. So not all is gloom and struggle and sacrifice in the world of nonviolence. Thank you very much, and until next episode, as my co-host Stephanie would say, take care of one another.
Dedicated to all spiritual activists, true seekers, and peaceful warriors worldwide.
I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
Once upon a time, not long ago, there was a boy who would grow and become a great soul. He lived in India, and his name was Gandhi. He believed in human rights, and he fought for equality. He felt so strongly that he trained himself, cause he realized first he'd have to change himself. He changed his clothes and decided to walk. Some days he practiced silence and refused to talk. When he was young, he studied to be a lawyer, and then he became a great spiritual warrior. He read from the scriptures of every religion, came to the realization that we're all God's children. Because he understood that we're all equal, he became a spokesman for the people. A karma yogi devoted to service, to spread truth and peace was his purpose. You gotta be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world. Just like Gandhi. Gandhi dedicated his life to the cause, even when it meant breaking unjust laws. He often faced prison and incarceration, but that only strengthened his determination. He said he would make every sacrifice, but that he would never kill or take a life. He used his heart instead of his fist, and he taught nonviolence as the way to resist. A peaceful soldier who used his mind to fight for the rights of humankind, but not just people, animals too. In his basic teaching, God is truth. He joined Muslims, Sikhs, and Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, Jains, and Jews. All the many paths that lead into the light that shines bright inside of me and you. You gotta be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world. Just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world. Be the change, just like Gandhi. Be the change that you wanna see in the world. Just like Gandhi. Gandhi taught an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind, and it takes more strength and faith to be kind. With that in mind, Gandhi took a stand against the foreign occupation of his land. When things got violent, Gandhi would fast, not eating for days until the riots would pass. But the biggest event that made the British halt is when Gandhi G decided to harvest salt. The British Empire installed a salt tax, and stealing salt was an unlawful act. So Gandhi and his peeps took to the streets, 10,000 deep they marched to the beach. But when they arrived, they were beaten with clubs, but they didn't fight back, instead they chose love. The foreign military realized they were wrong and eventually decided to go back home. You see, Gandhi G was a very great leader, but before all that, he was shy and meager. As a young child, he was just like you and me, before he became Mahatma Gandhi. The word Mahatma, it means great soul, and it's inside of us just waiting to unfold. If you follow your heart and act real bold, next time it'll be your story that's told. You gotta be the change that you wanna see in the world.